It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And of course, fresh herbs are delicious, but they're pricey if you buy them at the grocery store or the farmer's market. And once they've been picked, they have a pretty limited shelf life. This hour, we will learn how to grow our own herbs, or at least grow them better. Linda Nave is here. She's an Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. Linda, hello.
Good morning. How are you, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And it seems like some people just have sort of a magic touch with herbs. I have friends who have these amazing herb gardens that just seem to flourish weed-free, and then other people try and try and fail. So when you want to set up your own herb garden, where do you start?
Well, herbs are one of those really versatile plants, Charity, that you can grow them in a garden. You can grow them in and around your landscape plants because they really are rather attractive. You can use them as standalone planters on your deck, and they're very pretty. They add, if you have a combination of different herbs, they add a lot of color, different colors in the green spectrum. They have a lot of textural differences, height differences, but they don't go overboard. They don't get too large, and they're very easy to grow.
So when you're selecting the herbs that you want to grow, some are perennials and some are annuals. So you have to do a little bit of homework, right?
You do. And this is my recommendation. This is coming from my own experiences and recommendations and thoughts, is to have two containers, one for your perennial herbs, such as your thyme, your oregano, your rosemary, and another container for your annual herbs, such as cilantro, basil, etc. And the reason for this is the one with your perennials is the one you'll want to overwinter if possible, because they will come back year after year. Another perennial herb would be chives. None of those herbs, except perhaps the rosemary, takes up much room, and so you can grow chives with your oregano, with your thyme, and you're doing very well. The other option is plant them in a strawberry jar. A strawberry jar is one of those that's fairly squat or very tall and has these little pockets or balconies coming out the sides of the pot. You fill that with a good, well-drained potting soil and add your herbs into the different pockets. And there you've got a good selection of herbs in a very limited area. So that's another option. But having the annuals in a separate pot is so that at the end of the season, you just dump the pot in your compost pile and you can start over next year. So that's a good recommendation. Some of the annual herbs we're looking at would be cilantro and basil. If you're growing mint, that's a perennial, and I would always put that in a container. The reason is it's very aggressive in the garden. It sends out underground rhizomes that will actually grow under a concrete walkway, make its way all the way over to the other side, start taking over that planting bed. They go crazy.
Keep your mint under control.
Keep your mint under control. You could, if you want to put it in the garden, I would put it in a container first, and then it submerge the container into the garden so that it doesn't go out of its area. But it still might, because the stems might reroot outside the container, and there you go again. So mint is a fun plant to grow. It's great for a lot of uses, particularly as some of us like to get into some of the Greek foods. The mint is very popular with lamb. It's an excellent herb. It's just really aggressive.
So we're kind of lumping all of these herbs together. Do they need different growing conditions? Are there some that need a little more sun than others, for example?
The growing conditions, there are some that require a little moister soil levels, such as your annuals, your cilantro, and your basil. But the others are very tolerant of more mismanaged soils. So that's what's a really a good point with those, is that they don't require a lot of attention and a lot of moisture. I'll relate a story. I got a phone call from my daughter who planted an herb garden, and she says, "Oh my gosh, I haven't watered it. It was hot, and the plants are all wilted. They're all dead." And I said, "Just give them another drink of water." And she said, within a couple hours, they had perked up. So they're very forgiving plants at that, too. So don't overwater many of the herbs, such as oregano, thyme, parsley, rosemary. They like it a little on the dry side, but they're not as forgiving. They like to be watered but not overwatered. So that could be a problem. So make sure if you're putting them in a container, you have a good drainage hole at the bottom of the container to allow the excess moisture out if you have them outdoors and rains. So
okay.
They're not sitting in water.
How about if we're talking about container gardens, what about soil composition? Is there anything we should think about there?
Just a good potting soil is adequate. I wouldn't dig up soil from the garden and put it in a container. That tends to get too compact for them. And then the next thing is light. They do need sunlight. They don't grow real well in shade. But what I mean is they will grow in the shade, but they will get a little bit leggy and not put on the kind of growth that you want.
And so full sun is the recommendation, or it sounds like there's
full
a little bit of forgiveness
there.
Yeah, there
is a little bit of forgiveness. If you can get at least 4 hours of full sun a day, you're doing pretty good. The more, the better with the herbs, but 4 hours would be adequate.
All right. Now, you talk about overwintering in a container some of these perennial herbs. How do you do that?
Well, I would suggest either bringing them indoors, cutting them back somewhat, bringing them indoors, hosing them off before you bring them in, clean up any leaf debris that's in there so you're not taking that debris trash into the house, and you can bring them indoors. Otherwise, if you have attached garage or something like that, you can just put it in the garage against the wall that's near the house, and they will overwinter very well. Water them once or twice during the winter months, and I think you'll be happy with the results.
Now, a lot of people, after enjoying their herbs all summer, think, well, maybe I could just keep this going and grow them during the winter, too. Can you do that with any of the annuals?
You could try growing basil and cilantro in the house. The light levels tend to be a little low. They don't grow as well, but you could try them. Some people keep a basil plant over winter on their windowsill. That works very well. It's just a limited amount of harvest from it. But if you only need a leaf here or two here and there, it's adequate. But the really nice thing about some of these things is even now, almost approaching the middle of August, we can plant a pot of cilantro, a pot of basil right now, and have it ready for late September.
Wow.
So that's really cool. Cilantro is one of those plants that people really are excited about because we're using a lot of cilantro in some of our dishes today, but it's not the easiest thing to grow. And garden centers sometimes deceive us by selling little plants. My recommendation is never buy a cilantro plant.
Why is that?
Because they're short-lived. They're short-lived, and they only grow 30 days, 35 days, and they bolt real quickly. And once they bolt, you can't do anything about it. Bolt means send up the seed stock mm-hmm. in the center of the plant, and the leaves are not usable after that. And they do that very quickly. And they once they're transplanted, it puts them under a little bit of stress, and stress and high temperatures cause them to bolt rapidly. So I would suggest seeding them. It takes a little bit of time, sometimes 10 days or more, for them to germinate. But once they germinate, they grow quickly, they grow easily, and I think you end up with a better plant with more bulk to harvest.
And if they are short-lived, do you have to then seed and plant again as the summer goes on?
Yes. If you want multiple harvests, the best thing to do is to stagger your planting dates, do succession planting, as we say, and plant about every week to 2 weeks a new planting. And then as they start to grow in the summer, you'll harvest all of one planting, then you'll move on to the next. And it's a good way to do it. But you've got to be diligent and you've got to be watchful because under very warm conditions, cilantro will bolt prematurely.
Now, if let's say you have cilantro or you have basil and, mm-hmm. you know, something that is really doing well, you're getting close to the end of the season and you want to harvest that and be able to use it over the winter, what are some of your recommendations?
Well, you know, there are various strategies people use. Well, let's just talk basil, for example. Basil is something that if you were growing it at home, I would harvest it on a per need basis. If you're going to use it that evening in your meal, harvest it that day and use it. But if you're buying it or you're getting it from somewhere else, basil is very cold temperature sensitive and very easily bruised. And what I mean by bruising, if you bend the foliage, it'll turn black. Or if you smash it, if you buy it at the farmer's market and you put it in a bag, put a watermelon on top of it, it's not going to be worth much when you get home because it'll be bruised and it'll turn black quickly. So with basil, what I suggest doing is cutting the stems, cut the inch off the bottom of the stems, put them in a glass of water or a vase, because they are kind of attractive and they smell wonderful, and just keep them on your kitchen counter. Don't put them in the refrigerator because they will turn black real quickly because our refrigerator temperatures are typically colder than what the basil will tolerate. Now, if you want to save some herbs like thyme and oregano, there are a couple ways you can do that. You can also put that in a glass of water or a bowl of water. Take the bundle, almost like a little bouquet, and put it in a glass of water. Cut the stems, put it in a glass of water, about an inch of water. Or you can rinse them well, pat them dry, wrap them in moist paper towels, just damp, not soggy, but damp paper towels, and put that in a sealed zip-top bag and put that in your refrigerator. That should last almost a week or so. Do that with dill, oregano, thyme, rosemary, mint that you buy at the farmer's market. That will help preserve it and keep it for a little bit longer period of time. Then don't just set your bundle in the refrigerator. It needs to have something to keep it moist and not lose moisture from the foliage.
Now, I've seen people freeze herbs in ice cube trays to try to preserve them for the winter. Is that something you think works?
Yeah, it works really well. If you have dill weed and the dill's coming up and growing well, but you've got far more, which most of us do when we plant dill, than we ever use on our green beans or our carrots or whatever, put about a tablespoon of dill in an average-size ice cube tray. Fill the rest of it with water, freeze it, and then take the ice cube tray and take the ice cubes out when they're frozen and put them in a separate Ziploc bag. And then you just grab an ice cube when you need one that's filled with dill.
All right. Well, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. We've been talking about herb gardens. So if you have any follow-up herb questions, of course, you can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is also with us today. So any insect questions, you know what to do. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture, and Donald Lewis is here today as well, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today, and of course, if you have any questions, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Donald, are you hearing anything unusual about insects in Iowa right now? Any frequent reports?
We're in the summer doldrums. We're still getting people telling me how many individual Japanese beetles they have collected off their tree, because 3 years ago, people were collecting Japanese beetles by the buckets full. Then we had that drought in late 2013 and the freeze over the winter of 2013-2014 that pretty much knocked the population down to almost zero. And so last summer we found almost none. This year we're finding a few. So people are noticing that they were here, they disappeared, but they're coming back. People also noticed early in the spring, early in the summer at least, we had huge populations of mosquitoes that came with the frequent rains. Those populations are down a little bit now, actually down quite a bit across the state, but we've had enough rainfall that mosquitoes are not going to go away, and in fact, another week or two, we could have another population explosion.
Well, so, I just spent a weekend camping in Michigan, and I remember why I moved back to Iowa, because Michigan has all the mosquitoes.
All their mosquitoes, and I suppose they are the size of hummingbirds and can suck
a small dog
dry in a single bite. Yeah, we've heard about those. But it's been lots of little things this year compared to any one big thing happening. So I always love the variety, and it's been a good year for that.
Well, and people seem to be hyper aware of monarch butterflies and monarch caterpillars right now because everybody cares so much about the future of monarchs. I'm seeing so many people posting about it on Facebook, and there does seem to be more milkweed around.
Oh, I think so. You can't throw a milkweed without hitting a newspaper article or a radio program or a Facebook post about milkweeds and monarchs. People have caught on to the message that we've lost lots of the monarchs over the year, and that over the last 20 years or so, and much of that has to do with a loss of the habitat and the food plant that the monarch caterpillars depend upon, and that's milkweeds. So there are all these efforts to reestablish milkweeds, to leave milkweeds alone in the fence rows, to put milkweeds back in your garden, to not treat them as a weed, but to treat them as a valuable resource so that we can help the monarchs. We have a huge hill to climb in terms of overcoming the loss of milkweeds on 125 million acres of corn and soybeans in the upper Midwest. But all these little efforts are helping and providing habitat and food that those butterflies need.
All right, let's get to the phones again. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Alex is on the line in Ames. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I just recently purchased a house, and we have a huge, oak tree in the backyard. And I noticed one day walking by, there was a huge pile of sawdust on the bottom. And I looked up, and I noticed that there were some, what I believe are carpenter ants, digging out my tree. And I was wondering what I could do about that.
Carpenter ants happen. If you have any dead wood, decayed wood, hollowed trees, logs on the ground, old stumps, carpenter ants will find that, and they will move in, and they will do what they are supposed to do as ecological recyclers. They will chew up wood, spit it out as sawdust so that it can decompose and break down in the environment. They are not attacking the living portion of any standing tree. They will be in dead, decayed wood. So ants are not your problem. Ants are a symptom that what might be a problem, and we need to evaluate how much decay is in that tree. Is it hollow? Is it just a small area that's decayed? An arborist or a tree care professional can help you with that determination. Ants are easy to control. You can treat the nest with insecticide. You can spray the tree to kill the ants as they go up and down foraging for food, especially at night. But the ants are not the tree's enemy at this point. The ants are just taking advantage of a spot that already exists, and that spot is wet, decayed wood that we need to investigate further.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right, Alex, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Here's an email from Bob in Wayland. I'm noticing a lot of cottonwood leaves falling. My neighbor reports seeing the same thing at a local state park. We live on the river. It's not drought related. It seems very early for cottonwood leaf drop. Any thoughts?
I don't have good thoughts, but I can add to that that ash trees are doing the same thing. Ash trees are dropping entire leaves. Ash trees have a compound leaf with a stem in the middle and then leaflets on the side. It's not the leaflets that are letting go and dropping. It's the entire leaf that has formed an abscission layer. Horticulturists and foresters have been talking about this. We can't find an insect problem. We can't find a disease problem. And when we don't have a better answer, we blame the weather.
I knew that was coming.
And so something about the weather has set this up for the tree leaves to form abscission layers early. I think cottonwoods do that regularly. I don't think of that as quite so strange, but the number of leaves of under my ash tree in the backyard has been rather startling, and it's going to be bare a little earlier.
Which
than
I'm
usual.
Sure scares a lot of people because they're waiting for their ash trees to decline.
That's right. But this is not a symptom of emerald ash borer. This is something else that's going on with the ash trees. But as near as we can tell, the great growing conditions, the great water we've had for our trees this year, some combination of factors has put it into place that trees are dropping leaves a little early. Nothing we can do about it. We can't go back and change what happened in the past. Rake them up, mulch them up, and add them to the compost pile or mix them in with your grass clippings, and we'll wait and see how these trees respond next year.
All right, and we have a related question from Robin in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay, I have a maple tree that seems to be, the smaller branches are being populated with little, I don't know if they're scabs or aphids or what, but I was wondering if it was related to the wet weather we've had, and it's actually killing off the clumps of leaves. They're maple. It's a maple tree.
Mm-hmm. I suspect
and,
more than
and
one.
It's and the branches are actually, the smaller branches are just white.
Right. There you go. That was the word I was waiting to hear. You probably have several things going on, but in spite of the wet weather, which we generally think of reduces aphid populations, we have had a bumper crop of woolly aphids on maples this year. Woolly aphids have kind of a pinkish-purplish body, but they very quickly cover themselves with these waxy white filaments. And they have those filaments as wingless nymphs on the branches, and there will be clusters of dozens of these aphids on every foot of the twigs. And it's usually the twigs that have a little thinner bark because they are feeding on sap from the tree through the thin bark. So woolly aphids on maples have been very abundant this year. And in the adult stage, you will see these woolly aphids flying through the yard, and it looks like a little piece of lint that is flying through the air because they keep that white, waxy wooliness with them when they develop to the adult stage and have wings. This is not generally a problem for maple trees. We have larger populations than we've seen in the past, and it's getting late enough in the season that control is probably not going to be necessary to protect the health and vigor of the tree. If you can, what you can reach safely, you could treat with insecticidal soap. You could rub them off with a gloved hand. It's going to be a gooey, juicy mess when you do that. But this is something that just happens occasionally, and we don't think we need to treat, but we want to keep an eye on those trees to make sure there's no further stress.
I have a question, Donald. If they had patio furniture under that tree, would that be covered with a honeydew residue?
Yes, indeed. These aphids are feeding on sugar water, and they're taking in more sugar and water than they can digest, and so they excrete the extra as honeydew. Honeydew is our euphemistic term for the excretion, the excretion that comes out when they can't digest it all.
That's a much nicer term.
Yes, it is. There are several things that were running through my mind, but I stuck with the euphemism. And that will be on the leaves. The leaves will be shiny, sticky. The patio furniture, your car, the sidewalk will be all sticky underneath from this honeydew excretion. And then flies, wasps, and bees, and butterflies, and moths come and feed on the honeydew, and the ants feed on the honeydew because it's a sugar-rich, moist resource. So it's a cycle of life, and the maple tree is kind of the start of it. But the maple tree is the dead branches you mentioned are probably not just caused by the aphids. So maybe next year will be a good time to have an arborist or a tree care professional come and evaluate, trim out the dead, see what's left. But at this point, there's probably no need for anything other than avoid additional stress.
All right. And don't put your patio furniture underneath the tree,
if you can help it.
All right. Robin, thank you so much for your call. Next up, Ralph's on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Hi there. So what are Macintosh good for? Eaten or sauce or what?
Your Macintosh apples are a great, have a wonderful flavor, but they're not a real good fresh eating apple for an extended period of time. You can eat one just fresh right off the tree.
Yeah, they don't store well.
They don't keep well, so they are the perfect processing apple for applesauce that you're going to can, for anything like that. Eat apple pies. Use them as soon as you can because they don't keep well, and they tend to bruise easily in storage too. So use them, but they have a wonderful flavor. So if you're going to the farmer's market,
really like them.
Yes, yes.
I think deer like a lot of different kinds of apples. I don't know that they're particular about Macintosh. But Ralph, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Carol in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a beautiful specimen mature oak, and there is a volunteer tree that has just landed itself in right around the trunk, and I want to know what I can do to get rid of it. And then I also have a Sienna Glen maple, which is I just planted a couple 3 years ago. I think I need to elevate it, but I don't know when or how.
So do you know what kind of volunteer tree, and is this something you're trying to relocate?
Oh, no. I think the birds have planted it, and I think it might be a walnut.
How big around is the stem of that little tree?
Oh, it's probably, if you put your index finger into the crook of your thumb, that's about how big the trunk would be.
Oh, easily to take a lopper at the ground level. That'll take a good, that'll work to take care of it. And if that doesn't, it keeps sprouting back, you could use some of a non-selective herbicide on it. It could be like Roundup, and it won't kill the oak tree. But if you selectively just put it on the little seedling, it'll kill that pretty good.
And you could, if you lopped it off, you could just paint the stem,
you could
the stem,
paint the stem as well, yep.
Very direct delivery.
Just keep cutting.
Just keep cutting it, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the maple tree, you feel like you need to replant it because it was planted too deeply to begin with and you want to...
No, I just need to elevate it. When I mow under it, I have to duck my head. So I just need to raise the branches up a little bit.
That's a much different
process. That's a different
process.
Term.
Yeah. Different process. Yeah. We call that limbing up.
Limbing up, yes.
Oh,
or removing
okay.
some of the lower limbs. And that's an interesting story because we go round and round, my husband and I. He likes to limb things up a little more often and frequently than I do. When you do that, just as the tree grows, be sure you don't take too many of those limbs off at one time. And the best time to do it probably is summer, fall. You can do it in the spring, but they bleed heavily. So be careful. Don't take too many. And do it when they're relatively young so that that scar heals over. And get it so it's not doesn't leave a little stump or stub when you prune it off. So you want to go just outside the bark collar.
Okay, but it should have a little bit of a stub, shouldn't it?
You'll see this little, what we call it, the collar, or a little ridge around that branch as it comes off. You want to go just to the outside of that.
On maples especially, this collar is a little farther from the trunk under the branch than it is on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you look at that, how that branch is forming and where that collar we're talking about exists, you're actually going to cut on a slight angle. Your cut won't be perfectly parallel to the trunk of the tree. It will be on a slight angle, the bottom of the cut a little farther from the trunk than the top. But if you look up this branch collar ridge or branch collar, this is pretty popular amongst horticulturists and arborists and tree care professionals to look for this branch collar and make sure you cut at the right angle to so it heals as fast as possible.
All right, and when is the best time for Carol to do this?
Oh, you can do it right now, actually. You can take it off right now. It'll be fine. You don't need to paint that small branch. It'll heal itself if you have a nice clean cut. So go ahead and take that branch off now, and you'll be fine.
All right.
And Charity, I thought you were looking for the answer. Horticulturists prune when the saw is sharp. That's when to do it when the saw is sharp. I've also heard horticulturists use the rule that when it's more than an inch but less than 2 inches, there's a good time to limb up and take off trees. So that, you know, you don't want to take them off too soon, but you don't want to let them get too big either. So that's a nice range, I think.
All right. Budge is on the line next from Bettendorf. Hi, Budge.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Last spring, my mother gave us a peach tree in memory of my mother-in-law. It was a great gift, and we planted it, and it flourished and produced all kinds of fruit. But unfortunately, this year, there's only one peach on it, and the tree's otherwise healthy. And I wonder if you have any idea what's up.
Yeah, I do. Where are you from, Bud, by the way?
Yeah, I live in Bettendorf.
Bettendorf, okay. Yeah, Bettendorf is over on the eastern side of the state. And the problem with peach trees is they're not reliably productive. They're short-lived trees, to be honest, and I hate to say that too, but that's the honest-to-goodness truth. But this year we're seeing some situations where peach trees bloomed early, and then we had a little freeze, or in particularly isolated freezes, that was just enough to knock off the blooms, and so we didn't get a good fruit set this year.
There's always next year, at least for a few, huh?
Right. There is always next year.
Well, and a lot of fruit trees are cyclical like that anyway, aren't they?
Sometimes it's weather, good old weather related, like late freezes. And fruit trees such as apples, for example, and pears tend to have a more of a biennial production cycle. than things like cherries, and peaches is more weather dependent.
Okay. All right, Budge, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to answer more questions. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture, Linda Nave, and Iowa State University Extension Entomologist, Donald Lewis. So give us a call with your plant and your insect questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you can join our conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Linda Nave here today and Iowa State University Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. And let's go back to the phones. Dinah is on the line in Ames. Hi, Dinah.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I am enjoying your program immensely. My question is that we have a large patch of Monarda in our garden, and it's drawn lots of bees and bumblebees and a few hummingbird moths, including one that I can't identify. The hummingbird moth looks sort of like the bumblebee sphinx moth.
Right.
But it has a strong white band across its midsection.
Across the middle of the wing?
No, across the middle of the body. I think the wings move so fast, I can't see them for sure, but I think it might be a clear wing sphinx moth.
Yes. And when we talk about hummingbird moths and bumblebee moths, we've got a lot of species to choose from, and you've named a couple of them. The one with the white band and the clear wings... The name's escaping me, but it's not coming up. But that whole group, they're all fascinating to see. They're all feeding on the nectar from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't pests, though,
no,
are they?
No, they're not pests at all. And I'll have to think about this, and the name will come to me. But yes, there is one with a white band. Okay, Charity, I'm not going to get the name. I'm going to have to get back to her.
All right. So when you think of it, you shout it out loud enough. Dinah's in Ames, so maybe she can just hear you wherever you are.
That's right. Or, Dinah, if you don't hear from me, send an email to insects@iastate.edu and ask me the name of the bumblebee moth with the white stripe, and then I'll email it back to you. That works for everybody, by the way. It's not an address just for Dinah.
Right.
insects@iastate.edu and ask your questions, send your pictures, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can with an answer.
All right. Sorry about that, Dinah. I'm sure it'll pop into your brain as soon as we get done with the hour, probably.
I'm thinking about halfway back to my office as I'm walking in front of Ames Lab Building, it'll strike me.
All right. Let's go to Steve next in Erie, Illinois. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your question?
Quick question about tomatoes. I have some healthy tomato plants, but the top third of the plant, the blossoms are turning brown on me. We've had a strange summer here, but I'm just wondering if I'm dealing with a blossom rot or something, or not enough water, or too much water. I don't really, it's dried up quite considerably here the last couple of weeks, let's put it that way. So what am I dealing with?
Well, first of all, I need a little more information. One is the blossoms blooming nicely to begin with? Do they look nice and yellow to begin with, or do they not even open? So they start out looking nice, and then they die.
Yes. Well, yeah, they just turn brown, actually.
Okay, they turn brown from the center, and they don't set a fruit.
Right.
With that, now, again, I hate to put it on the weather, but it could be the weather that's causing that to happen. Is the foliage looking nice?
Yes. Yes, it is. No signs of any insects or anything like that.
We went through a period where our temperatures were high in the daytime, and the nighttime temperatures never really cooled off, so we were at 70, 75 at night.
Right.
That will cause flowers on some varieties of tomatoes just to abort. They open and then they don't do anything, and they don't set fruit. High daytime temperatures and high nighttime temperatures can attribute to that. So I would say any fruit that's sitting on right now, you'll see that problem should pretty much end. Although right now we are in the 80s. 80s aren't the problem. It's when we get above 90 and daytime and evening temperatures 75 or so. So that'll cause those flowers. And oftentimes some varieties do that more regularly than others, are very sensitive to that temperature.
Okay, well, I was wondering if it was just the high temperatures and broad, it's full sunlight during the day, so I was wondering if they were just getting dried up. So I've been watering, and I'll get one more question. What's the best time to water? I know tomatoes like water, but should it be watering later on in the day or early morning?
Actually, we like to say, especially if you're overhead watering, is to water early in the day so the foliage has an opportunity to dry off in before nightfall. Because if the foliage goes into night wet, that's when we run into a huge problem with Septoria leaf spot and early blight, because it's spread with water on the foliage. So if we can keep that dry during the day, we're much better off. So water close to the ground, if you can, rather than a sprinkler, and water early in the day.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. John's up next in Manchester. Hi, John.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, I recently moved, and in doing so, I inherited a raspberry patch. And the plants are covered in the iridescent-backed beetles, and they're kind of decimating the leaves. Just wondering if there's anything I can do or if I need to do anything to manage those.
What was the plant again?
Raspberries.
Raspberries, okay. So you're talking about Japanese beetles. They're half an inch long, coppery brown on the back, shiny green on the front?
Exactly.
Okay. Pick them off by hand is one option. The option of spraying insecticide is not very attractive because we're harvesting at the same time the Japanese beetles are feeding on the foliage, and they'll feed a little bit on the fruits. So picking them off by hand or ignoring them if they're in low numbers, carry a little cup of soapy water with you, and as you knock them off or pick them off, drop them into the soapy water to kill them. Those are kind of the options. Now, insecticides like our old friends, 7, malathion, bifenthrin, can be applied, but then you have to wait several days before you can harvest raspberries again. So it's not a very appealing option to be using insecticides at this time of the year.
I don't know how big your patch, your raspberry patch is, if it's manageable.
It's about a 6-foot by 8-foot patch.
Then it's fairly large, but not a manageable size. So what I find works, you know, I use it on roses, is the soapy water trick, but I use a gallon ice cream bucket. And put a little soapy water in there. And the Japanese beetles don't cling on very tightly.
They play possum.
They play possum, yes.
They pull their legs in and drop.
Yeah, so what you could do is just go through, and where you see a large mass of them is just shake that branch into your bucket. And you will find that if you have a large number of them, they fall right into that bucket because, as Donald says, they play possum or they just don't cling on very tight. And there they go and start swimming in your soapy water bucket.
You also want to start this early because the damaged foliage actually attracts more Japanese beetles. So you don't want to let them eat and live for a while. You want to start early and pick the raspberries often and also pick the Japanese beetles often.
But only eat one.
That's right. Remember which one to eat.
Right. We have another Japanese beetles question. This is from Elizabeth in Montgomery County. She says, what can I do about the Japanese beetles? They continue to eat all my rosebuds. They skeletonized cherry tree leaves. Last year, they ate all the sweet corn silk, so I didn't plant it again.
The sweet corn silk is probably the easiest one. That if the plant has silked before the Japanese beetles nibble it off, you'll still get sweet corn. That is, if pollination has occurred. So just because they ate the silk off doesn't mean you won't get corn. That's true of field corn, sweet corn, popcorn as well. We don't have a lot of good options for Japanese beetles, but it comes down to, number one, tolerate them. Your tree, especially your linden tree, is going to tolerate that damage. So that's an option, is to put up with the damage. Number two, the hand picking that we've talked about. A big bucket with a little bit of soapy water, shake the plant, they fall in, start early in the morning when it's still cool. They're a little stiffer, they're a little less mobile at that time, so the picking becomes a little easier. Or use insecticides, beginning when the Japanese beetles appear, and repeat every 5 to 7 days according to label directions. Now, on food crops, like we just mentioned with John, that's a big issue because you have to spray, wait the number of days that are required before you can pick the produce. So when we're talking about food crops, we need to very carefully read and follow those label directions for the harvest waiting interval. Those are the choices. Live with them, pick them off by hand, or spray insecticide. Treating lawns for white grubs will not solve your ornamental or your food crop Japanese beetle problems because the beetles are very mobile. They're going to come from outside your treated area. They will still find your cherry tree, your raspberries, your linden trees, your grapevines, and your roses, even if you did treat your lawn. So there is no easy option to this. It's not an easy process. Last thing is, sure, you can buy a Japanese beetle trap at the garden center. You can put that up and catch anywhere from dozens to hundreds to thousands of tens of thousands. It will be emotionally satisfying to see all those dead, decaying beetles in the bag. It won't make a bit of difference to your plants. In fact, if you put the trap too close to your plants, it will attract more than it catches. So traps, if it makes you feel good, but you're not protecting the plant that way.
All right. So it sounds like maybe we're getting to see more Japanese beetles again. Well, at least a few people are.
What a full circle. This is right where we started.
Exactly.
We went through these huge population numbers. Most of us had a decline in population. But it's interesting, these little pockets are coming back a little faster than what we hear about from the statewide average. So Japanese beetles were high, they were down, but they didn't go away. They will be back, and it will be highly variable from now on who has them, who doesn't, and how many you have.
Here's a question from Linda in Des Moines. We have consciously tried to make our backyard and front yard friendly to bees. It seems to be working. And last week, we found that it appears a colony of honeybees has made a home in the soffit of a bump-out area of our house. They got in through a small hole that was left when we recently had the soffit replaced. We decided it was best to leave them be, but recently discovered that we can now hear them moving around in that soffit space from inside our kitchen. Their movements in this space are now quite audible. We don't want to harm the bees, but we're not sure if they could possibly be damaging the house or hurting themselves by living in the soffit space. Can you please help?
Yes, we can. Number one, do not plug the opening where they are coming and going. That seems to be kind of the logical, intuitive thing is, oh, if I just plug the hole, maybe they'll all die in there. No, they will get desperate and chew a new hole with a 50-50 chance that they will now be in your kitchen instead of in your yard. Number two, what color are they? And this is a little bit of a technical difference. The insects nesting in the soffit of the house or in the wall of the house are frequently yellow jacket wasps. Yellow jackets are bright yellow with black markings, and they are shiny, not fuzzy. Honeybees are golden brown to tan, and they are very fuzzy. So we need a close-up look at one of the offending insects to determine, are they yellow jacket wasps or are they honeybees? If they are yellow jacket wasps, we can treat that nest area. We can put insecticide into that hole where they're coming and going. We do that at night to reduce the risk. And we're not losing anything that is incredibly important to the ecosystem. We could also do that with honeybees if you can't find someone to take them. And there is no registry of beekeepers that will come and take bees out of your wall. You call your friends, you call your neighbors, you look up Iowa Honey Producers Association on the web. You look to see if there's a list of a director near you that you could contact. But if they're yellow jackets, we can treat them with insecticide and not have to worry about not being ecologically friendly to the bees and the pollinators. If they're honeybees, we could still treat them and protect the value of our house and not lose too much. Our other option, if they are honeybees, is to find a beekeeper. But bottom line, are they yellow or are they golden brown? And that's the next question we have to answer before we can decide what to do.
And since these insects overwinter in colonies, I mean, this isn't something that's going to be resolved by waiting it out and plugging the hole when it's cold?
If they are yellow jackets, the colonies are annual. And if they freeze, when they freeze to death in the fall, you can plug the hole and they will not be back.
Okay.
Honeybees form perennial colonies, and they will stay alive in the wall all winter by maintaining a constant temperature to keep the bees above freezing, and they will be there next year as well. So that would be another option, is to wait and see if they die in the winter. And if they are, if they do die, they were yellow jackets. If they don't die, they're probably honeybees.
Is that common for a honeybee to build a nest in a home structure like that?
I wouldn't say common, but it's not uncommon.
Okay.
So there must be a word that describes not common, not uncommon, you know, moderately common or something like that. But it happens, but
it's not a freak thing.
It's not completely rare, but it doesn't happen to everybody. But I would say over my last 30 years or so, the number of yellow jacket colonies in house walls has exceeded the number of honeybee colonies by almost 10 to 1.
Oh.
So it's much more common for yellow jackets to form these nests, these annual nests in wall voids, than it is for honeybees. But it could be either one. That's the problem.
Yeah. The yellow jackets are the ones that get into your pop cans and things like that, aren't they? And
yep.
Are attracted to garbage cans.
They feed on sweets in the fall of the year, so they only get into your pop cans if you're drinking real soda, not diet soda.
All right, let's fit in one more phone call. Hayes is on the line in Carroll. Hi, Hayes.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I recently moved to an acreage in the country, and it came with a really nice, large fenced-in garden area, and unfortunately it had not been gardened in several years because it had a really nice stand of grass, but I did a couple applications of Roundup to kill everything and then tilled it all under, and obviously this summer have been battling an endless parade of lamb's quarter and pigweed and lampshade and crabgrass. It's too large. I cannot keep up with it pulling by hand. Should I, in the fall, once the plants have stopped producing, should I apply Roundup again and try to kill everything? Or is there a better solution? Or should I just continue to fight it year after year?
Well, since it was in a weed patch for a year at least, if not longer, you've got a very large seed bank built up in your soil. And that seed bank will be there. And if you continue to have weed problems that go to seed, you're going to be putting more deposits back into that seed bank. Let's put it that way. So what I would do is check your weeds. I mean, they're going to be pretty tall. Your lamb's quarter could be 3-4 foot tall. Who knows? And your red root pigweed. I would go out and use a loppers or use a weed whacker and weed whack them down before they go to seed.
All right.
I would not continue to apply Roundup on that soil regularly if you can help it.
All right. So try to reduce that seed bank.
Right.
But it sounds like it's going to be a battle for a while.
It will be a battle for a while.
All right. We are out of time. So many people had questions. Sorry we didn't get to all of them. But thank you so much, Linda Nave.
Thank you.
And thank you, Donald Lewis.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
And, of course, we'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.